We're a few days away from the weekend, and in Hong Kong, that means a few days away from another set of street protests. They've been going on in one form or another since March, and on a larger scale since June. The coverage you see on television and hear on radio is dramatic and increasingly violent. There are big picture questions. How does this end? How much will Chinese authorities tolerate? What can they do to resolve this? We caught up late yesterday on Skype with Mike Chinoy, who was CNN's Beijing bureau chief at the time of the Tiananmen Square crackdown. He's covered Greater China in one form or another since the 1970s. At CNN, I worked with him in Asia on stories from the Kobe earthquake to presidential elections in Taiwan. He talked about how the protests in Hong Kong are having an impact on the city that goes way beyond the pictures on television.
It's extraordinary. I mean, it's, as always, the pictures make it seem worse than it is, in the sense that you could be having protesters throw Molotov cocktails and being tear gassed and, you know, two blocks away, be quietly sipping a beer and, you know, be barely aware that it's happening. So, no, 4 months in and no one has been killed. So, you know, just keep a certain perspective. But all that being said, it's terrible to see the city just sort of spiraling downward, and it does really affect daily life. What subway stop is operating, what streets are blocked, and it's now part of the calculation of daily life. So it's just these little things that erode the sense of daily life, compounded by the fact that nobody has the slightest idea how this ends.
In some ways, it's hard not to make a comparison of Hong Kong to Beijing in the days before Tiananmen. Do you see any similarities there?
It's really different. The Tiananmen spring of protest was caused by a whole series of, you know, domestic issues in China, and also was the result of a kind of decade of political and social liberalization that was the hallmark of the 1980s in China, and that brought to the surface all of these internal tensions in Chinese society. The only real parallel that I would see is that the controversy over the extradition law in Hong Kong, this law that would allow people in Hong Kong to be extradited to mainland China, where nobody trusts a legal system that's run by the Chinese Communist Party, was the catalyst bringing to the surface many years of frustration and anger among many people in Hong Kong over the way the political and social and economic system here was operating. And what we've seen is a tremendous frustration and anger and resentment, both on this initially specific issue of the extradition law, but then broader complaints about how Hong Kong is governed and about economic inequality and so forth. So I guess the parallel, to the extent there is one, is simply that the protest movement brought to the surface deep-rooted frustrations within the population about the way things were going. But the specifics are obviously very, very different.
And in terms of daily life in Hong Kong, you mentioned, you know, disruption to the subway system, to transit. What is life like?
It's very strange. There are times of the day and places around Hong Kong where you would never have the slightest idea that anything is going on, but it is in the background. And what we've seen has been almost every weekend for 17 or 18 weeks, major clashes between protesters and police, demonstrations, the use of tear gas. But life sort of goes on anyway. And what you feel is that it just becomes part of your daily calculation now. You get up in the morning and you check which subway lines are running, how long mass transit is going to operate, whether there are any protests scheduled. What's happened recently, because the situation has deteriorated dramatically and become much more violent in the last week or two, has been that the subway service stops now at 8 o'clock at night. And this is a night city. This is a place where shops stay open late and restaurants stay open even later. And people are out on the streets at all hours. So it's very, very disruptive. And people just have to factor in, can you get around? My wife was going to meet a friend for lunch the other day, and it took quite a lot of calculating to figure out where they could meet that they could both get to, and how could they have their lunch and figure out how to get back before public transport stopped. So that's just the way it is here now.
And what is a potential or possible way out of this? What's an ending to this?
One of the reasons why I am so worried about the situation here is that, like many other people who are watching it closely, there is no clear-cut way out at the moment. You have a Hong Kong government that created this crisis to begin with its obtuse and thoughtless attempt to introduce this extradition law, which has been politically clueless and inept at every step of the way. This is a political problem, and it requires skillful politics by the government to try to bridge these divides and blunt public anger. But you have a government that is politically hopeless and seems to have no ideas about how to proceed, except to take steps to invoke emergency laws, which they've just done to make it illegal for anybody to wear a mask at a public protest. There's no sign of dialogue on the side of the government. The result has been that among the protesters, people are becoming more and more radicalized, and you now have a hardcore, it's very difficult to estimate the numbers, but significant numbers of people who really want to fight. And you see this now playing out on the streets. You get these protests where young people dressed in black with helmets and gas masks and body armor, carrying clubs and hammers and wrenches, are ready to engage in street fighting. They're ready to vandalize shops and businesses that they see as owned by companies that are linked to Beijing or whose bosses have spoken out against the protests, or their biggest target has been the subway system, the MTR, Mass Transit Railway, because it's government owned. And initially, that was the way people got to and from these demonstrations. And then after it was criticized by the state media in Beijing, the MTR started changing its when it operated certain services to make it more difficult for demonstrators to get around and easier for the police. And so the demonstrators now see the MTR as the enemy, and they have systematically attacked MTR stations. And one reason why mass transit has been so badly affected is that many of these stations have suffered real damage. And I watched the other day in a fancy shopping mall on top of an MTR station, people came in with hammers and crowbars and smashed up all the ticket machines. And there are instances where people have set fires at the entrances to the MTR. So there's clearly a hardcore people who are spoiling for a fight, and there's no obvious political initiative coming from the government, which has put the Hong Kong police in a terrible position, because the police have essentially become the major interface between the authorities in Hong Kong and the population, since the government is not engaged in any political way. And so that's further radicalized the population and further antagonized people and made people deeply resentful of the police, which is a profound shift in how people viewed the Hong Kong police. So there is no obvious political way out, and therefore I'm deeply concerned that this pattern of violence is going to continue and get worse.
You've seen the Beijing government in different guises over many decades now. How can this be playing in Beijing?
Beijing has got to be absolutely furious about what's happened in Hong Kong on many, many levels. First of all, they have to be furious at Hong Kong chief executive Carrie Lam, who created the whole crisis absolutely unnecessarily with her stupid decision to try and ram through this extradition law when it wasn't needed, and when, as far as I can tell, Beijing didn't ask her to do it. But now what we've seen over the last few months has been something that in China would have been suppressed violently as soon as it first began. You see people burning Chinese flags. You see people denouncing Chinese leader Xi Jinping. You see them attacking mainland Chinese or people who are have spoken out in support of the government or
and you see all of this on international television, by the way.
Well, you not only on international television, and the Hong Kong TV networks are showing all of this live, so you can literally sit in your living room and just watch the city go up in flames day after day, night after night, weekend after weekend. So this has got to absolutely infuriate Beijing, and there's been tremendous speculation about what will China do. Will they send in the army? Will Hong Kong become Tiananmen Square 2? I covered Tiananmen Square 1, so it's something that I thought about as well. But Xi Jinping is really stuck here in the sense that he's damned if he does and he's damned if he doesn't. If he does order that kind of crackdown, it will be the end of Hong Kong as we know it. You'll see an exodus of international businesses. It will destroy all the things that make Hong Kong separate and unique and therefore valuable to China. Freedom of expression, an independent legal system, a safe place to do business. It would be a terrible stain on China's image and would elicit all kinds of international condemnation. And it would cause serious financial damage because Hong Kong remains a crucially important financial center, and it's mostly with Chinese money coming through here. The Hong Kong Stock Exchange is very important to China. So there are lots of ways in which cracking down would be very, very damaging to China. And it's not at all clear that it would work either, because just in terms, just purely operationally, Hong Kong is a much tougher nut to crack than Tiananmen Square was. Tiananmen Square was a large square in the center of a flat city in a capital city that the Chinese Communist Party had levers of social control in every street, in every neighborhood. Hong Kong is an urban jungle of 7.5 million people cramped into teeming high-rises who speak a different dialect, who are utterly antagonistic to mainland China. So simply bringing it under control would be a lot more difficult than it seems. On the other hand, if China lets this go, Hong Kong is going to become this kind of rallying point for resistance to Beijing and to the excesses of the Chinese Communist Party. It's already become that. You hear people talking about, you know, Hong Kong has now become the center of what I think is a growing sense around the world of unease or criticism or opposition to the way the Chinese Communist Party behaves. You're seeing pushback in the United States in terms of U.S.-China relations. You're seeing debates in many other countries about the wisdom of certain kinds of dealings with China. You see it in the debates about whether the Chinese telecom company Huawei should get permission to provide the 5G services for countries in the West. But Hong Kong is kind of at the sharp edge of that. So it's become the symbol of resistance to China. And of course, Beijing is most terrified that the idea of resistance will filter across the border into mainland China.
We're talking with Mike Chinoy. He's a Hong Kong-based non-resident fellow at the University of Southern California's U.S.-China Institute. He's covered Greater China for several decades. And Mike, how do you think this is all playing out in Taipei?
The government in Taiwan is watching this very, very closely. The whole concept of one country, two systems, which is the framework that was created for Hong Kong to return to Chinese sovereignty while maintaining its own Western-style economic, social system and lifestyle, was basically devised by Chinese leader, late Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping, to lure Taiwan to have some kind of rapprochement with mainland China. The fact that the trigger for these protests, the deeper trigger for the protests here, has been a growing unease that China wasn't honoring the promises in one country, two systems, and was seeking to erode Hong Kong's freedoms, is really at the center of what's driving what's happening here. And the way the Hong Kong government has responded and the way the Chinese government has responded, certainly in terms of its language and its support for getting tough and for the Hong Kong police and its denunciation of the protesters, I think is being seen in Taiwan as further proof that the idea of one country, two systems is a complete non-starter. Taiwan has presidential elections in January. My guess is that what has happened here is going to provide a big boost to the incumbent president, Tsai Ing-wen, whose party, the Democratic Progressive Party, is generally seen as more sympathetic to the idea of an independent Taiwan, and which is hated by Beijing. Because people sit in Taiwan and they look at Hong Kong and say, if we have one country, two systems, that's our fate as well. So it's generated a lot of unease, a lot of support and sympathy in Taiwan for the protesters, a lot of contact between some political activists here and people in Taiwan that didn't exist before. But it's serving as a very strong advertisement that one country, two systems, as we see it play out in Hong Kong, is not something that people in Taiwan, they don't want to go down that road.
And in terms of Hong Kong itself and the sympathies of the people there, you alluded earlier that the protesters seem to have the sympathy of the population generally. How is that now, and how do you see that playing out?
We've seen evidence on the streets. There was a demonstration earlier in the summer, which by all accounts, 2 million people, which is more than a quarter of Hong Kong's entire population, took to the streets. And there's no question that a lot more people who didn't go on the streets supported the demands for political change. But not everybody does. And one of the things that we have seen has been really profound rifts in the society here, divisions over the protest movement have split families, split couples. It's a little bit like in the U.S., where feelings about Donald Trump run so strong that they've destroyed friendships, that people don't talk to each other anymore. It's the same kind of thing here. And there's a sense that you're either with us or you're against us. And so you've got these really sharp cleavages in the society. My sense, and opinion polls suggest this, is that a significant majority of the people in Hong Kong certainly support the peaceful protest and certainly support the demands, first that the extradition law be withdrawn, which finally and grudgingly the government withdrew it, but also demands that the government authorize an independent investigation of behavior of the police, that the chief executive, Carrie Lam, stepped down, and that genuine democratic reforms, which were promised to Hong Kong under what's called the Basic Law, which is the document governing its return to Chinese sovereignty, actually be implemented. I think there's a lot of public support for that. But there's still really, really deep divisions. And one of the things that is worrying as the protesters have become more radical is that you've now seen episodes where People who have challenged the protesters have found themselves beaten bloody, threatened. There have been some very, very ugly incidents involving more extremist types on the protesters' side in physical confrontations with people who disagree with them. And earlier in the summer, we saw clashes where people antagonistic to the protesters, wielding cleavers, tried to attack some of the protesters. So this has created enormous rifts in Hong Kong society, and you just within the society, and then you add to that this tremendous ill will and antagonism between many Hong Kong people and the police force, and total lack of faith and confidence in the government. It's very hard to see how Hong Kong gets put back together again, even if the street protests stop, because the public faith in the institutions that make a society work has been so badly damaged, and I'm not sure how that can be fixed. So in the long term, beyond the immediate what happens every day on the streets situation, I think Hong Kong's future is very much at risk. Its image, it likes to market itself as Asia's world city, but its image as a place where companies can come and set up and do business and feel confident operating because the legal system works, that it's safe, the government is competent and efficient. It's a jumping off point to do business with China precisely because it's not like China. All of that is at risk. So there are very profound longer-term implications of this, and I don't see how Hong Kong goes back to what it was 6 months ago, regardless of how this plays out.
Mike Chinoy is a Hong Kong-based non-resident fellow at the University of Southern California's U.S.-China Institute and has covered Greater China for many decades. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.